Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of clinical experience in patient-centered, proactive, preventive, and personalized care. In this conversation, we're going to talk about creating a resilient workforce. Our guest is Dr. Richard Safier. For the past 25 years as a workplace health pioneer and thought leader, Dr. Safier has assessed cultures, trained leaders, and conducted and explored research on the intersection of individual and organizational behavior. Dr. Safier currently serves as the Chief Medical Director of Employee Health and Well-Being for Johns Hopkins Medicine, where he leads the Healthy at Hopkins Employee Health and Well-Being Strategy. Previously, he was the medical director of preventive medicine for Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield in Baltimore, Maryland. In January 2023, with publisher Wiley, Dr. Safier released A Cure for the Common Company, a well-being prescription for a happier, healthier, and more resilient workforce. Dr. Safier is the first author to provide a step-by-step roadmap for creating a well-being culture that integrates science with practical solutions, as demonstrated by the numerous real stories from successful companies. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Family Medicine, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and the American College of Preventive Medicine. He serves on the New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst Insight Council and previously served on the board of directors for the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Rich, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Shannon. It's good to be here.
So, Rich, what got you interested in workforce and workplace culture?
Well, I certainly didn't grow up thinking I was going to land in the position I'm in today. I think around the end of my first year of being a practicing family doctor, I started to realize that it was really difficult to have a meaningful conversation and help my patients understand the root cause of their condition in only 15 minutes. And as much as I was running between patient rooms, my patients were running back to work. So everybody was running and busy. And I realized they're spending 15 minutes with me, but almost 2,000 hours in the workplace. And I quickly saw the light bulb, and I knew that I needed to be there. That if I was in the workplace, that I'd have a much bigger impact on their health and well-being.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, Rich. And in your years of being involved in helping the workplace culture around well-being, it's evolved a lot, right? Like I remember 30 years ago, like when I was in residency, the word workforce, resilience, and culture and wellness and well-being just were not in the vernacular. So how would you say that's changed, and what were the driving forces behind the changes that we've seen?
Yeah, you know, there were only a few companies back in the 70s, like Johnson & Johnson and DuPont, that were really proactive and helping their workforce, not just because they knew it was a nice thing to do and they wanted their employees to feel healthy and well, but they understood the connection between the health and well-being of their workforce and the success of their company. And I have to give a number of researchers a lot of credit in the 80s and 90s, such as the late D. Eddington, for helping employers understand the connections between health and economic drivers. I would say, though, there was, in addition to the science helping, there was also an economic force happening where insurance had evolved so much that it had left behind prevention. And so here we had employers who were offering insurance policies to their employees that lacked that help to keep them from getting to the point where they needed to go to the doctor or the hospital. And that created a gap, an economic opportunity for a wellness industry to pop up. And so where there's potential money, companies come in. I would say around 2010, the gig was up and employers started to realize that the traditional workplace wellness wasn't working. It might have been working for a few companies, but the majority were not finding value in it. And then unfortunately, some well-meaning people had already started using the word well-being, but there was a whole part of the economic sector that rebranded themselves. Instead of workplace wellness, they were now well-being. And then we saw that jump to workplace culture around 2018 or 2019. And again, some companies just rebranding themselves, and some companies or individuals understanding the true meanings behind these different words.
And these words are thrown around almost kind of as an equivalent, like wellness and well-being. What is the difference between those words?
Oh, that's an interesting question, Sharon. And because that's been presented to me many times, and even inside Hopkins, the discussion, well, should we use the word wellness? Should we use the word well-being? Should we use the word health? Because really, health, for many people, if you look back in history, it was the full spectrum, not just disease, but the optimization of an individual's potential. So where I've arrived at, Sharon, is that I try to respect whichever word, wellness or well-being, that somebody else wants to use, because I think that for many, it's a personal decision, and there's so much more that we need to focus on to help each other to move forward. I know that sounds like I'm skirting around the question, but I would invite your listeners to look at the World Health Organization and see their definition of wellness.
Yes, exactly. Because I think there's the beyond the absence of disease, right? So that's clearly something that's a goal. I was just wondering if you thought that one encapsulated the other, if you view it that way at all?
Well, I don't see one being a better word than another. I prefer well-being because I think it implies more of Eastern medicine's foundation. And I think that at least in the cultures and the circles that I work with, there's an underemphasis of that. And by using the word well-being, it may draw attention to it. Now, Sharon, I studied nutrition in college, and we studied everything from the impact of culture on nutrition and all the way to the microbiology and biochemistry of food. And one thing was consistent during that time, which was in the 80s, a little while ago, was that health meant the entire spectrum. As I look at it from a historical perspective, having gone through all these different stages, count me as a little bit cynical, but the arrival of wellness and well-being as our society knows them was mostly driven by industry, companies that were looking to create a niche to help others.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I think a lot of things enter our culture that are driven by like products and programs and offerings. So that's very interesting.
Yeah. Can we reflect on culture though, since that seems to have arrived at its time?
I would love to. You actually read my mind. I was going to ask you, you use that term workplace culture and specifically why you choose that term.
So in the meantime, I finished residency in 1996, and so I've seen this evolution, and I was part of some things that worked and, frankly, part of some things that didn't work. And probably around 12 years ago, I came to the realization that we really need to look at a much broader picture, like culture. So culture, at least how Webster's defines it, Webster's Dictionary, for those of us who remember Webster's Dictionary, is the shared attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs of a group of people that have something in common. Shared behaviors, attitudes, and beliefs. And our culture impacts our decisions, our physical, our social, our mental well-being, much more than we give it credit for, and certainly much more than we pay attention to it that it deserves. So not only did I need to arrive at thus far giving an incomplete solution, but once I started to respect the power of culture, which I should have back in the 80s when they taught us that in nutrition education, I had to try to figure out how do we intentionally shape culture, because most of the time a workforce and a company doesn't already have a supportive health and well-being culture. And that's where some of the research came about and trying to put together this roadmap that not only do we use here at Johns Hopkins Medicine, but also that other companies are using parts or all of the framework.
I want to take a step back before introducing culture, because when companies just offer programs, you know, like various initiatives, different programs people can sign up for, why does or doesn't that work? And why is there a need for culture?
Well, some programs might work for some people because they might be at a certain stage of their journey, their well-being journey, where they're prepared and have made adaptations so that the program and the content of the program is received in a productive manner. But that's not the majority of the individuals. There are a lot of forces around us that we don't respect that are impacting our decisions and our thought processes, mainly our peers. Those could be our friends, our coworkers, namely our manager. They impact our health and well-being much more than we recognize, namely norms, which is the social power of expected behaviors, namely the environmental cues around us. So there's all these forces, Sharon, that are subconsciously, sometimes overtly, influencing us that programs don't account for. And programs are no match for the overwhelming and omnipresent impact of the culture in which we live and work.
Right. And, you know, it's reminding me of behavioral economics, right? Like our brains will take the path of least resistance.
That's right.
And exactly as you're talking about, can you give some examples of how that works?
Well, I can give you examples of behavioral economics because that is part of the framework. Now, I don't call it out as behavioral economics. I use the words culture connection points, because there's many other culture connection points in addition to behavioral economics. But for example, in the workplace, if you put a bowl of fruit in the middle of a meeting table with forks and bowls, there's a good chance people are going to eat that fruit. If you put a plate of donuts in the middle of that table and they're not together, there's a good chance people are going to eat the donuts. So the path of least resistance, if someone's hungry, is what's in front of them, as you mentioned. I could give, you know, dozens, if possibly hundreds of examples of how the workplace can be built and structured where the default makes it easy to have a healthy and well day or more difficult.
Right. So it seems like there's really two components to this culture, right? There's this driving behavior subconsciously, which can be driven by placement of food, by, you know, plate size, things of that sort. And then there's the influence of individuals on individuals, right? Like this kind of social contagion that starts to happen as well.
Right. So social contagion or the spread of our mood or our behaviors, that would be norms, is powerful. And we can just default and not pay attention. And it's going to be driven by the loudest person or the most person who has the most powerful position of the group or economic forces. Or we can be intentional and create a team culture or an organizational culture where it's easier for each of us to have a healthy and well day.
Yeah. And I remember reading the 3 degrees of influence really around the social contagion related to health habits. I believe it was James Fowler and Nick Christakis.
And Nicholas Christakis, yes, from Harvard.
Yeah, who did work around that. And for our listeners, it's the influence of 3 degrees of separation from that central node of behaviors that relate to obesity, for example. And I believe they did some other metrics. You may recall that as well. Realizing the power of just social connection and the social contagion and the power of how we design our environment. How can workplaces use that information? Because despite this knowledge, it seems like a lot of workplaces don't implement this into their well-being culture. Like some do, some don't. Like you said, some do it better than others. How can it be done well?
Well, first, you know, I honestly don't believe that most leaders understand this portion of creating a healthier workplace. So I don't think there's any malintent. I also don't think that the economic drivers of this work, such as companies for profit who are trying to earn the contracts of companies, have figured this out either. So beyond getting educated, the way that we practically make this change is by helping those whose job responsibilities are to create a well-being culture in the workplace, but not stop there. We also need to train our volunteers. So if you have a wellness volunteer network, we call ours Healthy Hopkins Champions, they need to be part of the solution. And leaders at all levels need to be part of the solution, because there's such a strong component, Sharon, as you mentioned, this idea that it's people or social contagion that need to be involved, that there's always going to be a problem if an individual comes to work who's having a bad day, which is the reality, and isn't aware of how their bad day might be impacting those around them. Now, I'm not saying people shouldn't have bad days, but I'm also saying that if we all appreciated each other's bad days and helped each other with those bad days, we'd all be better off for it. But right now, most teams and workplace cultures are not equipped to help those people having a bad day. And what happens is that bad mood can spread to others and inadvertently cause other people to have, quote unquote, a bad day.
Is that something that happens best at a local level? So that individual clearly works with a small group, and that small group, of course, probably reports to a larger group and on up the corporate hierarchy. Is it bottom up, top down? What's the best way to influence that culture?
So I don't think there is a best way, and I actually think both ways is better than only one way, and I'll tell you why. The organization is responsible for creating the infrastructure to support the health and well-being of the individuals within that organization. But it's really up to the teams to make that ideal, to optimize the daily experience. So an organization has a culture across the entire workforce, but then each team has a subculture. And so, for example, about this infrastructure, if team leaders don't realize that smiling is contagious, and that if they want to put their team in a better mood, all they really need to do is smile, then how are they supposed to use that simple skill? So the infrastructure includes training managers. The other side of the house, you know, this ground level, this grassroots, is that teams need to show an interest in having a healthier and better day. They have to somehow be inspired that whatever they're experiencing now doesn't have to be the same way tomorrow. They can be part of a solution where they can have a better experience at work. And we have to help empower them to do that.
And with that, Rich, let's pivot to work that you've done at Hopkins. I know you've started some programs there, some lifestyle-based programs, I believe, around hypertension. How have you implemented these pillars at Hopkins?
Yeah. So first, I'll say that there is a place for programs within culture, but they are not equal to each other. And that is unfortunately misunderstood. So we do have a 10-week lifestyle medicine program focused around blood pressure. It's called Keep Your Pressure Down. Similar to other lifestyle medicine programs, we deliver it to a cohort of employees, and each session, we have 18 sessions, we are teaching the participants a new skill, more information. There are things we ask them to engage in between sessions. But what I think we do differently from most other employers is that we embed this in a workplace culture that's supportive of the skills that they're trying to achieve. And Sharon, we spent many years shaping our workplace culture before we actually rolled out our lifestyle medicine program. So let me give you some examples of what this looks like. Like many lifestyle medicine programs, we help our participants recognize that sodium, too much of it, can raise blood pressure. So if you have high blood pressure, you want to eat a lower sodium diet. And not only do we teach our participants how to read a food label, but we inform them, hey, when you're within the Hopkins workplace, if you're in our cafeterias or you're at our vending machines and you see a green leaf, you know that that's a low sodium food. So you don't have to even think about it. There's a behavioral economics example, Sharon. We just made it easier for you. We also teach our employees new skills to help with their stress level. Much of that is around being mindful. And we have not only teach them some mindfulness in that, but we help them realize that every day, every Monday, they can participate in Mindful Monday, a 15-minute mindfulness exercise with whomever logs on to the virtual program that day. We remind them that they have the benefit of a subscription to the Calm app. And so we are regularly integrating the resources that we have available into our lifestyle medicine curriculum.
And how much support do you have? You know, like you mentioned, you can offer the mindfulness and a subset of people will certainly join. I imagine some teams are ones that embrace the culture and probably have more members participate. Some teams maybe have a different microculture and perhaps zero people from one team join. How do you expand your reach, or is that even a realistic goal?
I'm going to tell you how we expand our reach, but first I just want to reflect on this idea of people participating in our programs. And it's certainly great when they do. And if they don't, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not engaging in their own health and well-being practices during the day. We also know that some teams create their own health and well-being strategies without the support of our infrastructure. And that's a beautiful demonstration of grassroots that has been empowered either by the resources that they've seen or the messages they've heard. Now, how can we expand our reach? We have a pretty robust Healthy at Hopkins Champions Network. We've also been pretty successful in engaging our leaders at all levels of the organization. We have five different training programs for leaders at different levels. Some of them are voluntary. Some of them are mandatory. Some of them are 10 minutes. Some of them are more than an hour. Some of them are in person. Some of them are virtual. And we introduce well-being during new employee orientation, and not just what are the benefits. We actually teach them 4-7-8 breathing, and we couch it in the context of, hey, sometimes you're going to be stressful. Here's a practice that we do. So Sharon, we leverage the infrastructure of the institution to magnify our work.
Are there metrics you use for measuring whether you're making progress with culture, with programs?
Yes. Which do you want me to answer first, culture or programs? Or just kind of expound on measurement?
You know, I'll let you set the framework of how to think about that.
Yeah. Measurement's really important for us. It's important for us so that we know if it's working and if our employees like it and if our employees are utilizing a resource. If employees aren't even utilizing a resource, then we need to stop supporting that resource because that's time and energy that can be applied elsewhere. Numbers are also important, though, to our leadership. We think it's very important to demonstrate that the resources that are being allocated to our effort are being put to good use. So we look at a wide range of metrics. Some of them are biometrics like blood pressure, and some of it is opinion, like what do our employees think about the culture in our workplace? In fact, for probably 7 or 8 years now, we've had a culture of health survey. We get thousands of employees who answer the survey. There's 12 questions. There's 2 questions for each of the 6 building blocks in our culture model. And that tells us where we're doing well and where we could do better. And not only do we get this data for our entire workforce, but we also have data that we can look at by hospital and by outpatient center. And so we can kind of narrow where there might be a specific area that we can support. There's a whole bunch of other metrics, like sales of healthy foods we used to measure. We stopped because we saw that the purchasing pattern changed. And so we also have to be practical, Sharon. We can't measure everything forever. There are some things we've measured and stopped measuring.
Mm-hmm. And with workplace well-being programs, you know, there's sometimes, you know, it sounds like you and Hopkins and this whole concept of culture is sharing that kind of responsibility of wellness with individuals. Whereas I know there are certainly some programs and institutions where the emphasis is more on the individual making changes in their own life. Can you speak a little bit about that?
That really puts the individual in a tough position. I mean, most people know that if they ate more apples, they'd be healthier. And most people know if they quit smoking, they'd be healthier. So it's really not a matter of, I think, not usually a matter of being more educated. It's usually a matter of building new skills and being supported by the people you work with and the environment in which you work. I really genuinely believe that if an employer is only providing benefits and programs and resources, then they're really not optimizing the potential that each individual within the workforce has to have a healthier, more well day. Which is why, Sharon, we've been using the CDC Worksite Health Scorecard for 8 years now to measure the policies, benefits, resources, and interpersonal assets that support employee health and well-being. For those of your listeners who are not familiar with the CDC Worksite Health Scorecard, if you want to look it up, great, but I'll just tell you, it's an organizational assessment tool. It's not the only one out there. There are other organizational assessment tools in this health and well-being space that an employer can choose. It's basically letting them know, how much are you doing to put in place a more optimal state so that your employees stand a chance of making healthier choices. But I'll also remind forewarn everybody, an organizational assessment tool does not equal culture. So don't misconstrue the two.
Rich, with the time we have left, is there anything you want to make sure that our audience knows that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
Yeah, and boy, there's so much here, Sharon. Most of the people who are listening to you today are probably people who have jobs. I would ask you to think about who you work with and think about what types of habits you're either trying to create or get rid of. Who on your team can you ask to support you? Because there are probably some people on your team who already have that healthy habit. And hopefully you're either comfortable already or you can get more comfortable with asking your coworkers for help. The second thing I'd ask you to consider is, what is your relationship with your manager like? And you know, you might have a quick answer, it's good or it's bad, but think about how that relationship is impacting your own health and well-being. If you spend some time thinking about it, you may come to the realization they impact your health and well-being more than you realize it. And I'd ask you to try to figure out a path forward that's better for your health and well-being. Because if you don't try to adjust and optimize that relationship, the chances, again, of getting to a healthier and more well place will be challenging.
Mm-hmm. That's really great advice. And Rich, for people who want to learn more about you and the work that you do, where can they find you?
You mentioned in the intro, there's a book called A Cure for the Common Company. And it's a book about having a healthier, more well day during your work day. While it was written for human resource professionals and managers and folks who do the work similar to Sharon and I, it was also written in each chapter for the reader to turn it around and provoke some thoughts about how you could have a healthier and more well day by these ideas of peer support and leadership. I would also ask people to think about going to richardsaphir.com if you want to read some blogs about this work, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. I post fairly regularly about workplace well-being.
Wonderful. Rich, thank you so much. And thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me, Sharon. I really appreciate being part of your community.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.